This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. More than any other industrialized country, the United States provides the opportunity and expectation for individuals to succeed. Most do well, some very well indeed, but for any number of reasons, some fail. In the 1930s, under President Franklin Roosevelt, the government established safety nets for those in need. Over time, these grew to include Medicaid and Medicare, food stamps, child tax credits, and, of course, Social Security. With the Reagan Revolution of the 1980s, the pendulum swung back toward personal rather than collective responsibility. Taxes and spending for social programs diminished. Welfare was redefined. For his second term, President Bush hopes to transform the tax code and reform Social Security to conform with an economic philosophy he calls an ownership society. Ownership, the president says, delivers security, dignity, and independence, and gives everyone a bigger stake in the future of the country. But are there also risks? Today on Talk of the Nation, we'll explore what an ownership society might look like, its benefits, its risks, and the underlying philosophy. Later in the program, an update on the political crisis in Ukraine. But first, the ownership society. If you have questions about the risks and rewards or about how it might play out in your life, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'll hear differing views from our guests. We begin with Stephen Moore, who's with us here in Studio 3A. He's the president of the Club for Growth, which supports tax cuts and smaller government. He's the author of Bullish on Bush, How George W. Bush's Ownership Society Will Make America Stronger, and it's good to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Neil.
Well, let's begin with a definition. Exactly what does ownership society mean?
I don't know, Neil, if you remember those old Prudential television commercials where their slogan...
You can get a piece of the rock.
Own a piece of the rock, that's right. And that's sort of what this idea of ownership society is, that every American should own a piece of the rock, that every American, within the next 10 years, will own their own home. You mentioned that George Bush has been trumpeting the fact that now we have two-thirds of Americans owning their home. It's a great trend. We would like to see America move from 50% of Americans owning stock to 80 to 90% of Americans owning stock. Business ownership. One of the hallmarks of the American economy is that we are a very entrepreneurial economy. Americans like to start their own businesses. We should create incentives so more Americans can be business owners, owners of their own small businesses. If you do all of these things, you create an economy, Neil, where the American worker now has a direct, they're stakeholders in how the American economy is performing. They care now very directly about how the stock market performs. You know why? Because they own stock themselves. They care about overall business conditions because they own their own business. They care more about their neighborhoods because, you know, if you own your own home, you know, you care about the property values and you take a stake in your neighborhood. So for all these reasons, I think what George Bush has stumbled upon is a very exciting idea that can make America a richer place.
And I guess this goes back, it's sort of the flip side of that famous remark that nobody ever washed a rented car.
Very well put. And it is true that your whole attitude about life really does change if you become an owner. I have a quote in the book, believe it or not, from Jesse Jackson. And Jesse Jackson, in one of his famous phrases, once said, "Without capital, capitalism is just an ism." And that's right, that we need to have, to make capitalism work, we need to have capital. And wouldn't that be wonderful if we were a nation of owner capitalists? Not so that under this model, Neil, Americans would not just make money from their wage income, but they would make money from the assets that they own.
How does ownership society differ from laissez-faire capitalism?
Well, we're not, obviously, I like laissez-faire capitalism, and I'm not a big fan of government intervention in the economy coming from the Cato Institute. But we're not talking about, you know, abolishing the welfare state. Let's take, for example, Social Security, where President Bush and groups like the Cato Institute have talked about a new deal, a true new deal for Social Security, where you would essentially, rather than having workers send, you know, 12% of their paycheck each pay period into the Social Security system, they would be able to keep a portion of that money and put it into an individual retirement account. So it would still be a forced saving plan. You'd still have to put some of your money away for retirement, but now you would actually have a personal ownership of the money that you pay into the system. Right now, when you pay your money into Social Security, you don't have a personal ownership. In fact, you don't have a. This may come as a surprise to you, Neil, but when you send in your checks to the Social Security system, you don't actually have a legal right to that money. If Congress wanted to come along, they could cut the benefits and take it entirely away from you,
or tell you, no, you're not retiring at 65. Exactly. You're going to retire at 67 or 68.
And they may very well do that. So this is the idea that you know, there was a wonderful. Let me just say one last thing. There was a wonderful story just in the newspaper about a week ago about a gentleman who had worked as a janitor his whole life. I think he was in Florida, but I don't remember the exact details. And he had never made over about $40,000 a year in his life. And he just left something like $2 to $3 million in an estate for Florida State University. And everybody was surprised. Where did he get this money? Where did he get it? Because he had invested in stocks early in his life. And Albert Einstein once said that the most powerful force in the universe is compound interest. And through that compounding, he actually died a very rich man.
But there are situations that are, you know, again, some will do well with their these investments that they make and this fund that they control. And regrettably, some will not. Is there going to be a safety net for those who do not succeed?
Yes. Yeah. For example, with the Social Security system, many of the programs would have a guaranteed minimum safety net, so that if a person invested poorly, you know, and that happens, or if you retired at a time when the stock market crashed,
or the stock market went into a long and profound,
right, anyway, then you would be sort of protected. So that's why this isn't just laissez-faire capitalism. But I should say this: you know, we've done a number of studies that show that it is true that the stock market, Neil, is a very risky place to put your money if you're investing for the short term. But if you're investing for 15 or 20 or 30 years for your retirement, the one piece of investment advice I'd give to your listeners is the stock market actually over a long period of time is a very safe place to be. The long-term rate of return on the stock market since the day the New York Stock Exchange opened its doors is about 7.5% after inflation. That's a pretty good return.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. We're talking about an ownership society and what it might be like. Right now, we're speaking with Stephen Moore, who's president of the Club for Growth. And if you'd like to join us, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Nick, who's calling from Sanford, North Carolina.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I enjoy the show very much. Just want to say that first of all.
Appreciate it.
My question is that this seems to be a recreation of the past. It seems like the ownership society was very close to what we had in the 1920s and the early 1900s. And I think if we're going to recreate the past, aren't we failed to repeat the lessons that we once learned from the Great Depression? I mean, everybody seemed to own stocks back then, and look where that got us. And as far as the rate of return, that doesn't take into account for a great failure of the stock market. It can be great over a long period of time, but if it has that steep decline, how do you account for those 10 or 12 years or whatever it takes to grow ourselves out of the hole then?
Okay. We'll get a response, but I think, first of all, the everybody was not invested in the stock market back in 1929. Isn't that right, Stephen Moore?
Yeah. We have today one of the things that's kind of an exciting new demographic trend in America is that a record number of Americans own stock today. In fact, if you go back to the late 1970s, only about 1 in 6 Americans own stock. Today, as I mentioned earlier, just about 50% do. One of the reasons...
This is mostly through pension, yes, or 401k.
That's right. In fact, one of the things that happened in the late 70s, early 80s was we created things like 401k plans and pension plans that made it easier and more lucrative for people to invest in the stock market. And that's been a great thing. You know, if you look, one of the shames of this idea is that somebody didn't come along with this 20 years ago, because if you go back to the early 1980s, you know, the stock market in 1982 was at 1,000, the Dow Jones. Today it's at 10,500. Imagine that we had, rather than, you know, a third of all Americans being in the stock market, you know, 75% of them, we would have today a nation of millionaires. So I really view this as a way of, remember the old Louisiana governor, Huey Long, who talked about sharing the wealth. Mm-hmm. This is why I wish more liberal Democrats would embrace this idea, because this is the ultimate way in the American society to share the wealth, so that if Microsoft or companies do better, then all Americans do better.
Nick?
Yeah, I'm still listening.
Okay.
I guess that answered my question. I didn't realize there wasn't as many stockholders.
Many fewer.
Right.
Yeah.
I get kind of scared with the whole idea of we'll let the business of, you know, economy run our lives. I kind of have a security in knowing that I have a Social Security interest and knowing that I'll be taken care of if I should happen to lose everything. And I'm afraid that if we go to this ownership society, those of us that don't study well in high school are going to be penalized for the rest of our lives, I guess.
Nick, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks.
James Surowiecki expresses many of those same concerns in an article in the New Yorker magazine. He writes the business column, The Financial Page. He's also the author of The Wisdom of Crowds, and he joins us now from the studios of Connecticut Public Radio in Hartford. Good of you to be with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I know you've been listening to the conversation thus far. The risk aspect of this, that is what concerns you.
Well, I think the thing to remember about Social Security is that Social Security isn't just a forced savings program. It wasn't designed just to be a way of getting individuals to save money that they would then be able to tap when they got older. It, like Medicare, is really social insurance. And insurance works best when it's collective. What Social Security is really designed to do is allow the society as a whole to share the risk of people losing their jobs or of industries going out of simply failing ceasing to exist, et cetera. And, a lot of what Social Security actually does is redistribute money. It actually redistributes money from wealthier contributors to poorer beneficiaries. And I think the concern is that when you move towards some form of privatization. And frankly, I don't believe that the ultimate goal of the Cato Institute is to have partial privatization. I mean, if the Cato Institute is being serious about its libertarianism, then it should favor complete privatization. And if you do that, then you're fundamentally doing away with the redistributive and social insurance aspect of Social Security. And that, I think, is a real problem, because I think the idea behind Social Security and Medicare was that it was simply unacceptable for a society to have people who had worked their entire lives who then, when they were older, for whatever reason, it was unacceptable for them to be poor or destitute. We simply were not willing to tolerate that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not convinced that Americans are willing to tolerate it.
Well, to be fair, we're debating the president's idea, not the Cato Institute's, and he has talked about some modification and not an elimination.
Well, I think that may be true in the short run, but I guess the long run question is what exactly happens to the economics of Social Security once you start to do away with sort of the social insurance aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I guess let me say two other things. One is the question of stock investing and the question of private accounts are actually separate. If we want to invest in the stock market, there's an easy way to do that. The government could very easily invest Social Security money in the stock market as opposed to buying bonds, which is what it's doing now. So it's certainly possible to invest in the stock market. Now, in contrast to Stephen Moore, I'm a little more skeptical of the idea that there is this massive risk-free kind of free lunch that's waiting out there in the stock market. The assumption that lies underneath this idea that if we invest in stocks, there's all these enormous returns waiting to accrue to us implies that the stock market right now is really getting things wrong. And I'm a little more – I believe more in markets than that. So I'm a little skeptical that there's an enormous amount of money waiting to be found in the stock market. So that's one aspect of it. That's distinct. And then the second question is really this question of – what happens to people who, make the wrong investment choices? And it's also not really clear that it's efficient to actually have millions of separate accounts, each of which are going to be charged 1% or 2% commission rates from Wall Street. All of that seems to me as if it really is going to erode a lot of the efficiency advantages of having a simple social insurance program.
Hold on with that thought. We have to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking with James Surowiecki, who you were just listening to, and also with Stephen Moore, about the idea of the ownership society. As always, if you'd like to get in on the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're discussing the Ownership Society, an idea the Bush administration is promoting for its second term. Our guests are Stephen Moore of the Club for Growth in the Cato Institution and James Surowiecki of the New Yorker Magazine. Of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255. You can also send us email, totn@npr.org. What is this Ownership Society? How does it work? We're specifically talking about the idea of Social Security, which seems to be one of the first that the president has been talking about. But James Surowiecki, before we get back to the phones, I did want to ask you about this idea of this as a philosophy overall. Ownership society, as with houses, this sounds great.
Well, no, it is an instinctively appealing idea, I think. And I certainly think it's a great way of selling these ideas, because I think ownership does have an instinctive appeal, particularly in the United States. And you know, I actually mentioned in my car, in my article, that line about the rented car. And there's certainly something to that. I guess when I look at the United States, I don't really see a society in which there's a lack of ownership. I actually think that people, for the most part, certainly compared to any other developed country, have far more responsibility for their lives. They take far more individual initiative and entrepreneurship than in any other developed country. And I think that, you know, Social Security, Medicare, these are sort of, as you said to begin with at the start of the show, these are really safety nets. And it's a recognition that in capitalism, you know, there are winners and losers. And that's just the nature of the system. And it's why the system is so healthy and dynamic. But, you know, in a wealthy society, we don't want to essentially condemn older people to destitution. And that's really what the idea of the safety net is designed to prevent. So, you know, I think we do already have an ownership society. And I'm not really convinced that the benefits of Social Security privatization, health savings accounts, et cetera, really outweigh the costs or the magnification of risk. The one thing that is unquestionably true is that when you move away from this kind of collective, more collective system that we have in Social Security and Medicare, you are shifting risk from society as a whole to individuals. So individuals are being forced to bear more risk. The question is, are they also going to reap greater returns? It's possible, but my inclination is I think all the evidence suggests that they're not.
Well, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation, and we'll begin with Rick. Rick's calling from Kansas City.
Hi. The problem with taking the Social Security money away or with changing what you do with it is that, you know, the Social Security money that I've paid in through the payroll tax for the past 30-whatever years isn't there. It went to my grandmother, and it's going to my parents now and my aunts and uncles. How are we going to deal with the transition from what we're doing now to taking away some of this money and actually putting it away for myself or whomever in this ownership account or whatever it is?
Stephen Moore?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the one thing you have to understand is that the Social Security system really is in unbelievably bad shape, because what's happened is, you know, this gentleman had it partly right. It is true that a lot of his Social Security money went to pay for his parents' retirement, but unfortunately, a lot of your Social Security money was squandered and spent on other government programs. You know, we over the last, I think it's about 15 years, there's been about $500 billion more collected in the taxes that this gentleman and other workers paid into the system than was paid out in benefits. So the question, what happened to that money? Well, it was spent on other government programs. You know, I was talking, I remember Lee Iacocca a few years ago said when he learned how the system worked, he said, oh, my God, if my company, you know, took the pension money, you know, that our workers paid in and spent it on other things, you know, we would be put in jail. So the Social Security system is in very bad shape. It's most economists estimate that the unfunded liability, that is to say, the amount of money we've promised to pay seniors in terms of the benefits promised versus the revenue stream that's coming in, there's an $8 to $10 trillion shortfall. And a lot of that, of course, is attributable to the fact that we have the baby boomers, people like you and me, Neil, who are going to be retiring in the next 15 or 20 years, who are then going to be drawing on these benefits. So you're quite right. We have this big problem. We have the Titanic headed to the iceberg. And the real question is whether we're going to have the wisdom to turn the Titanic around before it hits the iceberg and the ship capsizes. One way of doing that is moving towards a system of private accounts. We're going to have to borrow a lot of money in the short term to fix this problem. And these problems are baked in the cake, no matter which direction we decide to go. But the reward is that, you know, in the next 20 or 30 years, we will be leaving to our children and their children and their children a system that is fully financed, that does not have these sort of pay-as-you-go problems. Around the world, it's interesting. A lot of, for example, the former Eastern European countries, China, many of the South American countries are deliberately avoiding setting up a system like FDR did in the United States, which was really designed to fail because of this demographic problem, and are moving towards these personalized systems. In Chile, it's a very successful program. Can I just make one just quick point, Neil, about this issue of the idea of the idea that Social Security is a good deal for low income workers, and you know is there's this distribution to the low income workers. We found in many of our studies on the Social Security system that actually the people who get the worst deal out of Social Security system are precisely many of the low wage workers that are supposed to benefit. So, for example, the single demographic group that gets the worst deal out of Social Security is African American and Hispanic male workers, and that's because they start working at earlier ages and they have lower life expectancies. And so, for example, for an African American worker who is earning less than the average income, he actually gets a negative rate of return on his Social Security. He'd do better if he could take the money and just put it under a mattress.
But that's because they die earlier.
That's right. That's right.
But in terms of normal of workers who live a typical life, you're not denying that Social Security is a redistributive program, which takes money from the wealthier and gives it to lower income workers.
Well, that's not quite exactly true, because what happens, James, is that lower income workers tend to have lower life expectancies. You know, the people who actually benefit the most out of the system are rich white widows who, you know, live, you know, they have much longer life expectancies. And so really this is a program that redistributes income from lower income black workers who are male to higher income white females.
But very briefly, James Surowiecki, you have a situation. Mr. Moore is right about the Titanic approaching the iceberg. The other solution that some have talked about is to either raise taxes or raise the retirement age.
I believe that we need to raise the retirement age. I also think that Social Security benefits should be indexed to prices and not wages. One of the peculiar things about the Social Security system is that benefits are indexed to wage increases. So there's no way to kind of get ahead because, you know, traditionally in the United States, wage increases have outpaced inflation. But there's no way to get ahead because benefits are constantly being matched to that. So I actually think we should index which is something a lot of people talk about, index benefits to prices, that is to say match the rate of inflation rather than to wage increases, and raise the benefit age. I also think probably you'd probably be better off. You know, we have this strange cap where if you earn more than $87,900, you don't pay Social Security taxes on any of the money above mm-hmm. that. So if you earn $300,000, you pay the same percentage in Social Security taxes as someone who earns $90,000. That's somewhat peculiar, and I also think, and if you, well, yeah, I mean, as a percentage, you pay obviously significantly less. But so if you did those three things, I think a lot of the sort of crisis in Social Security would actually go away. The other thing, frankly, is that if you look at the economic numbers that those forecasts are based on, they assume a very low level of U.S. productivity True. Over the next 10 or 15 years. If U.S. productivity over the next 10 or 15 years is anything like what it has been over the last 10 years, then much of this crisis goes away, at least for a much longer period of time. But I do think reform is necessary. I just don't see how – I guess I'd like to get a clearer sense in our minds of how private accounts – that is to say, separating those private accounts on their own solve or keep the Titanic from hitting the iceberg. What's the answer?
Okay. Rick, thank you very much for the phone call, and we'll get to the answer to that question in just a minute. But joining us now on the phone from Heathrow Airport in London, which is the urgency we're talking about, is Frank Luns. Earlier we heard James Surowiecki call this idea of the ownership society a very appealing term. Well, Frank Luns is responsible for many turns of phrase which have changed policy. You may remember there was a great debate about the estate tax, which was not phased out until he decided to call it the death tax. Well, Frank Luns, very nice of you to be with us before your flight is called.
It's a pleasure. I apologize if there's a lot of noise behind me. They don't appreciate the quality of language that your listeners do.
Let me ask you about this phrase, though. The ownership society, is that something that's going to catch on, do you think?
Well, I find it very interesting, not just the phrase, but the whole terminology around it. The American people believe in the free market system more than they believe in capitalism. Because to them, free markets suggest the ability to buy and sell and get what they want, a lot of choices, whereas capitalism seems to represent wealth. Similarly, when you hear about the ownership society, that relates to housing, which is part of the American dream, owning your own home, owning stocks or bonds, which is part of owning a business. And so the public looks at this as hopeful, as an opportunity to really be investing in their own future. So, yes, I think it does. To use a colloquialism, I think it's got legs.
isn't it just a euphemism for capitalism?
Well, look, I mean, you can make the argument that the free market system and capitalism are the same, but if they perceive capitalism as being class-based and all about wealth and the free market system about opportunity and choices, then of course you're going to use the phrase free market rather than capitalism.
All right, let's get a caller in on this conversation. Moji joins us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. George Orwell said in 1984 that in 1984, which is today even worse, every word will have its opposite meaning. Now we have these terms, security, dignity, and independence, being related to ownership, but we know that ownership, I mean, all these three values, if you will, security, dignity, and independence, are inner-based. When you make them dependent on, when you own something out in the world, a little piece of miserable pie in the world, then you become insecure because you get worried about it's going to be taken away from you. You become dependent on this corporate savagery that we call capitalism, and it robs dignity because you're not self-reliant. You don't live from the earth. You don't live with true dignity. So it's an Orwellian term.
Well,
foisted upon people.
Frank Luns, we don't mean to nominate you as Minister of Truth, but there you go.
Well, I understand why he might feel that way, but the truth is you ask homeowners, do they value the ability to own their home, and they look you straight in the eye and say, absolutely, it's one of the things that they value most in life, to their relationships, their friends and family. Well, you ask people who own shares of stock, would they prefer not to? One of the things I've always had to explain to people is that perception is reality. To that gentleman, home ownership doesn't mean anything. To someone who plants a garden outside and raises their kids and has that little measurement that they can track as their children grow up against the wall, these things matter to them, and who are we to say that it's a legitimate priority or not? I think one reason why the American people tend to be happier than any other population on the globe and more forward-looking is because we don't allow people to make decisions for us about what is happiness. We are allowed to make those decisions ourselves.
We do require them to tell us when it's time to get on the plane, and I fear that time is approaching, Frank.
Well, no, actually, one of the dangers of language is when you don't pay attention to it. And so if you want to do one more caller, I've got time.
All right. Well, let me just say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Chris. Chris is calling from Boca Raton in Florida.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
If perception is reality, if I were to place a stick in a pond and look at the stick from the side of the pond, it would certainly not appear to be straight, but in reality, in fact, it would be. So,
and the point is?
The point is that my image of what's going on here is a bunch of greedy money managers and financial people standing over the cookie jar, taking their hands and rubbing them together, saying, tax breaks for the hungry, power to the government. And what about the idea of a social contract? If somebody pays into Social Security and now is being told, you don't really have a right to that money, we could take that money away from you tomorrow. Is that what America now stands for?
I think you've asked an important question. Chris, let's get a response first from Stephen Moore.
Thank you.
Just a second, we'll get your mic on. There you go.
Exactly the situation that you just described is what the current system is. That was my point, is that, you know, the Congress can change the law at any time. Even if you've paid in hundreds of thousands of dollars in payroll tax, there's a Supreme Court decision that's basically said that no individual worker owns their Social Security. So you're quite right. Under the current system, workers could be very much out of luck. Whereas if you actually own the money yourself, if it's in your own bank account, you know, Congress would have to, you know, take the money out of your account in order to get it. I wanted to make a comment about the previous call about this idea of, you know, is this a risky scheme? And I would say that the thing that's exciting about this ownership society idea is that if you go back to the idea of Marxism, it was this idea that there's this fundamental conflict between capital and labor. Right? You know, there's the capitalists and there's labor. What's exciting about the ownership society idea is that now the owners of capital are the laborers. So capital and labor are the same people. If the business does better, so do the workers. And that's a great way to share the wealth and make sure that even low-income people who today can't own stock will own stock and will then do better as the American economy does.
Frank Luntz, the social contract, that's a pretty good sounding phrase, too.
It's a wonderful sounding phrase, but the social contract is actually to give people the greatest happiness possible. It's a Benthamite philosophy, and unfortunately, with the current level of Social Security, it doesn't make anybody happy in any way.
Mm-hmm. Jim Sierowicki, can we get you in on this?
Well, yeah, I think the social contract is a great idea, I guess I again would say that I think the thing to keep in mind is whether privatization really is the solution to keeping the Titanic from hitting the iceberg, and whether privatization, the equation of privatization with stock ownership, which I think is what Stephen is talking about there at the end, those two things do not necessarily go together. And I also think that the point the caller made about the money managers, although this seems kind of subtle to people, is actually a very important one. That is to say, each one of those individual accounts is going to have some kind of money manager or account with a brokerage house or whatever it is. And they're going to have to pay commissions, 1% or 2%. So you add up all of the money that we're talking about going into these private accounts, and then you talk about what 1% or 2% of that means. And it's maybe not so surprising that Wall Street is kind of anxious to get this idea going.
We want to thank all of you for contributing to this conversation. We appreciate it. Obviously, we could go on, but we have to move on to Ukraine after the short break because of developments there. Frank Luntz, thanks for waiting for the plane.
Hey, thank you very much.
Republican pollster Frank Luntz. We'd also like to thank Stephen Moore of the Club for Growth and James Sierowicki of the New Yorker magazine for their time today. I'm Neil Conan. When we come back from the break, an update from Kiev. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.